Thank you. So I'll tell you about computations of the Higgs cross-section in the presence of a jet vector. There's been a lot of activity on this during the past year. We'll see, about 6 papers came out, even 2 more are about to appear. I'll go over these papers. I will first, however, discuss why it's important to have this jet veto and how what the challenge is associated with it. Then, since it's a blackboard talk, I'll actually discuss a little bit how this resummation works. I'll discuss the factorization theorem for the rate with the jet veto and some technical issues associated with this. And then at the end, I have some plots where I'll show you some results of our computation.
All
these 6 pages, well, there are some very interesting twists and turns here. It's like a telenovela or something. So I'll tell you about this, but let me first tell you what why we need the jet veto, and then.
Well, at least I agree with you, Phil.
I think so. Yes. No, there's reasonable agreement by now. But not everything is completely agreed upon by everybody. Anyhow, so, good. Good, so the jet veto is important in the Higgs decay to W pairs. Now, this is a big decay channel. I mean, apart from BB bar, this is actually the biggest decay channel, so the branching ratio is 22% or so. And by now, there are measurements at the level of 4 sigma. So let me give you the results. So ATLAS has a result for this at the level of 3.8 sigmas. So they see it. They also measure signal strength. And just to annoy you people who do new physics, they measure the signal strength to be 1.01, however, with a still significant error.
So the new PC is in the 0.1.
That is the plus
3.1. That's fully expected.
Okay. Now, let me split up the uncertainty here. So of this 0.3, there's about the 0.2 statistical uncertainty. There's here another 0.2 theory, and so this is what I'll talk about. And then there's experimental systematics, which is about 0.1. And so you see that already now the theory uncertainty is of the same size as the statistical uncertainty. So if we really want to make use of the coming data sets, we definitely have to decrease this uncertainty. And indeed, these computations that I'll talk to you about will decrease this error by about a factor of 2.
So how about HLHC? Is it because it's subclean and we don't need a jet veto?
Yes, I haven't told you yet why we need a jet veto at all.
I mean,
the reason we need the jet veto here is that there's a large background from top production. So I can have TT bar. And then the tops will decay into W's and B's. And so a top cross-section is more than 10 times as large as this Higgs cross-section, and so there's a huge background. However, the background comes in association with these 2 B-jets, and so you can reduce the background by imposing this jet veto. Now, what is actually done is that people split their analysis into jet bins. It's not that you want to throw away the case where you have 2 jets, but definitely the background situation is completely different. You want different types of cuts if you look at the 2 jet case than in the zero jet bin. And so, as I said, you impose this jet veto.
Sorry, so how well do we know the feedback?
Where is Ben? Ben will tell you how precise do we know the top background.
That's 10, 15, 20%.
or at least for the stuff that I use in the WWW. Because
that,
so I'm assuming this 15% here
is only
just from the
X. This thing doesn't use the two chat pin. So this so far only uses the zero chat pin, which is what I'll talk about, and the one chat pin.
Now, the question is it's on the signal or on the network, the theory?
Right, good question. I think looking at the, I know the theory uncertainty for the signal, and it is of this order of magnitude. So it's not the background that dominates here.
If you try to make a template that will fit whatever access, that's
the. Yeah, but I'm just trying to understand how well it affects the
future. Let me also give you, just write down CMS so that people don't get annoyed when they see the video. So here mu is 0.76. 0.21. Yeah, so for the zero chat pin, the background is just standard model WW production.
Good. How often do these things look like two W's, like they're boosted enough to where you can't really tease out the W's in any of that?
So the question is how many times you will miss both of these chats? I can look up, I don't know the exact number. It's small, but it's
not.
Sorry?
It's quite different kinematics.
Exactly, yeah. You can certainly do things about these W's, for example. I mean, there are many other cuts which people impose too in order to tease out the signal. For example, the W pair from the Higgs has the leptons aligned. So you look at small invariant masses for these two leptons, etc. Now, some of these other cuts are theoretically not that difficult to handle. The most difficult one is the jet veto, because you significantly cut on the QCD radiation. It's very small. It's smaller, certainly, than WW. Good, so what this jet veto is, it's just that you take the transverse momenta of your jets, and then you impose that it has to be smaller than a certain quantity, this veto, and in practice, this is about 25 to 30 GeV. And the price you pay when you cut here is that you end up with Sudakov logarithms in the QCD prediction. Sudakov logs. So you get corrections which are enhanced by double logs of this quantity PT veto over M Higgs. And okay, the scale hierarchy is maybe a factor 4 or 5 here. So you could think that these logs are not so large. It turns out the contributions are quite large. So when people first computed this jet veto and next to leading order, they found very small perturbative corrections. And at first, they were very happy about this. But you know that the total rate has very large QCD corrections. So the total rate has more than 100% next to leading order, and then another 60 or so if you go to next to leading order. So the fact that the corrections turned out to be very small means that these Sudakov logs are as large as these other large corrections. It's a cancellation of two things. The cancellation is clearly kind of accidental. The corrections to the total rate obviously don't depend on this PT veto, but for these values of PT veto, the Sudakov suppression from the cut is similar to the enhancement in the total rate. So there are two types of large corrections canceling each other. This is M Higgs NH. Good, now since I will discuss this factorization, I want to be a bit pedantic and actually define what I mean by the jet here. So this entire discussion is in this sequential recombination type of algorithms, like KT, anti-KT, etc. And so there's a measure which measures the distance between two particles. Depends on the transverse momenta, and then on the rapidity differences, and on the angular difference. And this is weighted by this jet radius r. This is the distance between two particles, and there's also a distance to the beam. The distance to the beam is just the PT of the particle. Now there's a power n here. If n is equal to 1, this is KT, the KT-Chet algorithm. If n is equal to 0, this is called the Cambridge-Aachen algorithm. If n is equal to minus 1, then it's called anti-KT. Now for all these factorization arguments that I'll discuss in the following, this PT dependence doesn't play a role, basically because both these distances scale in the same way with PT. So we can just, let's just set n equal to 0, and then the Chet algorithm is very simple. You look at all your particles. If the distance here is smaller than this Chet radius, you will cluster. You will continue to cluster and cluster and cluster until you end in a situation where all the distances between your clusters are larger than this Chet radius r, and then you stop and you call all the clusters Chets. So that's the algorithm. Good. Good, now I can maybe go over the literature. So, there are these Sudakov logs, and until last year it was not known how to resum them. Then Banfi, Salam, and Sandericki put out a paper early last year where they resummed these logs to next to leading log accuracy. After this, we put out a paper where we wrote down a factorization theorem, which in principle allows you to resum the logs to any accuracy you want if you have the necessary perturbative input. What we had was everything except one constant for next to leading log accuracy. We didn't have everything, but almost everything. The last missing ingredient, actually, we could take from this Banfi, Salam, Sandericki paper, but only if we also took a certain limit of one result they gave. They gave a limit, the limit r to infinity, and we wrote to them whether it's okay to take this limit. They said, maybe it should be okay, but you should be careful. We're not taking the limit. Anyhow, in our paper, we took the limit and saying, assuming that we can take the limit, we have the full thing. But it turns out.
Worrying about the log after.
Well, I'll show you this factorization theorem, our factorization theorem, and it turns out also theirs breaks down if you make this Chet radius too big. So I'll factor things into soft and collinears, but if you make the Chet radius very large, everything gets clustered into one thing. So this limit PT to 0 and R to infinity, they don't commute. And so there's an extra term, which they actually explicitly then computed. So you cannot take the limit, so this constant that we use gets corrected. But other than this, actually, our result completely agrees with their next to leading log analysis, which came later. And in the meantime, we also computed this two-loop constant ourselves. So we have an explicit analytic computation, and we fully agree with this. In between these papers, there was another paper by Tuckman, Walsh, and Subari. This was the day before the second paper by Banfi et al. Came out. They basically said you cannot have factorization, it breaks down at the next to leading log level. There are terms which break it unless this Chet radius is extremely small. And if the Chet radius is extremely small, then you get additional logs. You get logs of the Chet radius, which are not resummed. That basically means so the factorization theorem either breaks down or is useless, was their statement. So that was the day before the second paper came out. The second paper numerically checked that this next to leading log resummation works. So they checked that order alpha squared and order alpha cubed, that they indeed get the right logs. Obviously, the original statement you can no longer make, but I think they still believe that this factorization will break down on one level or another. So they still believe that there are terms which eventually will break factorization. They now say, well, presumably they will only arise at higher orders. So that is the conceptual thing which I want to discuss now, whether this factorization holds or not and why it holds. But then there were also papers that looked at the one jet bin by Liu at Petriello. I should maybe stress here, these are actually the first papers who really do higher log resonations for jet observables. So we often say the word jet, but when we do these resonations, usually we do event shapes or simpler observables. So these are the first ones which use a jet algorithm. These things here compute basically the zero jet case. The problem is if you go to more than zero jets, you can end up with additional so-called non-global logs. And so they have a result. However, there's a category of logs which is not resummed here. However, they claim that numerically these unresummed logs are very small. Exactly. So they don't have all the logs, but they claim that the ones they don't resum are numerically small.
The resummation for WW standalone background
layers
or
TT
bar PW background.
Sorry, whether
are there similar logs that you need to sample to give a background?
Yes. Yes, it would be interesting to do the same thing also for the background. And there are also other places where these jet vetoes are used, so there are other applications of the same type of format. No. So far, it's only the signal.
The TT bar, but the dominant thing is really
just
too hard
to
get.
Like, but you could now try to compute the background from TT bar, which will also have this type of Sudakov logs. So you would have to do an analysis of this thing in the case where the two bees basically go down the beam pipe so that you don't see them, and it would be the same type of analysis. But it's certainly more complicated than the thing that is. Is done, but it's not. Yes, you could do this exactly. The one more complicated thing is that this initial function, QCD function here, is more complicated. So in the Higgs case, for example, we have two loop corrections to this, which we include. Obviously, in this case, we don't really have these two loop corrections. But you could start at one loop. So certainly, one could do this, and one presumably should do this. The same thing. For WW, it's also important. For example, if you look at anomalous coupling searches, etc., you also need this jet veto, and it's the same issue, pretty much the same issue. So one should also do WW at one point.
This actually mildly exists in WW.
Exactly, certainly. I'm sure it's new physics, but maybe it could also have something to do with this. Good. So now let's discuss this factorization. And so what we will do is now we'll expand around the limit where this jet veto is very, very low to leading power in PT over M Higgs. So we'll take this cross section as a function of this PT veto and then expand in an expansion parameter, which I'll call lambda, which is just this PT veto divided by M Higgs. And okay, we want this to be low but still perturbative. So in a region where lambda QCD is much below PT veto, is much below M Higgs. And to describe the factorization, it's maybe easiest to use colored chalk. So now we're in a situation where this PT is extremely low, since we're working in this limit. And so then there are basically three things which you can have. You can either have emissions which go down the beam pipe in one direction, or you can have emissions on the other side, or you can just have soft stuff. So you can have soft emissions going here. Let me also draw the Higgs here. So somewhere in here there is also Higgs. And so then what one does in this effective theory framework is that one will, well, to analyze things, one will work in these light cone coordinates. So I'll define P plus to be P0 plus P3, P minus P0 minus P3. And, well, okay, if I square a momenta, it's P plus P minus minus P transverse squared. And now I have these three different types of contributions. The blue ones here, they have a large P plus. So let me draw here P plus, here P minus. So here I'll have M Higgs. Here I'll have M Higgs. A bit lower, here I have M Higgs. Here I have the low scale PT Vita, Vito lambda times M Higgs. Here I have lambda times M Higgs. Then I can put my contributions in different boxes here. So I can have this soft contribution where the transverse momenta is small and also these other things are small. So this P plus, P minus, the product has to scale like PT squared. So it's lambda squared and Higgs squared. And so there's the red box if you want down here, where the soft particles sit. Then I have the other one, the green one up here, which is the ones going to the left, which have a large P minus component. So I'll call these collinear bar to distinguish them from the other particles which go to the right. And finally, if I want, I can also look at particles which have both large P plus and minus, but these can only be virtual particles. So these will be virtual and are integrated out. So what one does is one splits momentum space into these boxes, integrates out the hard momentum box, and then one ends up with an effective field theory of QCD, which has these three types of modes, collinear modes and soft modes. If I...
What about soft and collinear stuff?
Good question. I mean, these arguments by Tuckman, Walsh, and Subari are exactly about this boundary region. Let me go a little bit ahead and then we'll come back to the discussion, basically what happens at the boundary between these two regions. And lots of, basically the entire first section here and most of my talk presumably is about how these things are actually separated or not separated. Good, so if I compute the rapidity of these things, then that's just 1/2 P plus over P minus. And so you see that the rapidity of the collinear ones, for example, is large. This goes like log 1 over lambda. The rapidity of the soft ones is order 1. And the rapidity of the anticollinear ones is very small, log lambda. And now we can look at the jet algorithm. In the limit where I take this PT to 0, the typical rapidities of these collinear ones here become very large. And the jet algorithm works like this, that it will compute all these differences and then cluster things which are close together. And so what the clustering will do is it will cluster collinear stuff here inside jets. It can also cluster anticollinear ones inside jets, or soft ones, but it will never cluster a soft and a collinear together, because these have generically a very large rapidity difference. And so what happens is, if you apply this jet veto in this situation, you get a veto on the collinears, you get a veto on the anticollinears, and you get a veto on the soft radiation, but no mixing terms. And so that's the factorization formula. So it says that this cross-section factorizes, can you see this? So it factorizes into first a hard function. This hard function just collects these virtual collections from loops where everything has virtuality of order M Higgs. So this only depends on M Higgs. Then there's a function here for the stuff on the right, collinear function, depend on some arguments. Basically, they depend on the rapidity, which is encoded in this Xi1, which I can give in a minute, and on the PT Vita times a function where I apply the Vito to these anticollinear ones times a soft function, which only depends on Pt beta. And I should write down somewhere what these Xi1 and Xi2 are. These are just M Higgs over square root of S times e to the plus minus the rapidity of the Higgs. And then one has to integrate here this thing over the rapidity of the Higgs. If you leave the Higgs at fixed rapidity, actually you would really just get the product as it's drawn here. Otherwise, you get this convolution of these three things. So that is the factorization theorem.
Yes? Is this supposed to be an exact statement, or this certainly breaks down somehow?
This is supposed to be a statement plus order Pt over M Higgs. So in all these factorization theorems, you do an expansion. So we do this expansion in this lambda, and this is to leading power in lambda. You will then resum, and then you add the subleading terms back. So all of these computations not only do this log resummation, but then they add back the power suppressed terms. So they're also doing the matching.
This is only assuming that the only cut is Pt cut, right? Because people have a lot of other experimental cuts. What about the optimization theory?
Yes, so what you also do in experiment is that you do rapidity cuts.
So
the rapidity cuts are not in here. They're a bit problematic because you would end up again with these non-global logs. And so Banfield has looked at this a little bit, but also not in great detail.
Non-global logs?
No, at specifically what happens if you put a rapidity cut, the one that is used experimentally. But the computations themselves are inclusive without the rapidity cut.
How do you, so 25 GB
of
M
Higgs
is
20%. Yes.
So should we think that
QE answer is 20%? No, as I said, if you wouldn't do anything, indeed you might miss 20% with these power corrections. But we'll add them back in fixed order. So what we'll do at the end is we'll take this formula to resum these Sudakoff logs, and then we'll add the rest in fixed order. Now for the rest will be alpha to the n log, but then multiplied by Pt beta over m Higgs. We don't really know how to do the resummation for the rest, even though we could try to derive a formula beyond the leading power, but it would certainly be complicated. But on the other hand, these are suppressed, and I will show you that it's about 10 or 15% numerically. And so for those, we don't resum, but we'll take them up to terms of our alpha cubed. Good.
So up to what order do you calculate these extra 5?
Alpha squared. So next to leading order, which is the best what is available for Higgs production. And all of these computations match to this order. So they're not only resumming, all of these should agree up to terms which are order alpha cubed. And now I want to come back to Antonio's question. Basically, how about this in-between region? You could think that if a particle happens to sit here, sort of in the soft part, right on this side, and another one right here, then still the rapidities are close. And so sometimes these things will cluster. That will definitely happen. However, if you look at this line, this is some intermediate scaling between these two things. So the question is there an intermediate scaling which also gives a leading power contribution? And I'll argue that this is not the case. Basically, the reason that it doesn't happen is that this yellow region here corresponds to some power-suppressed region of phase space. And the amplitude itself, it has these singularities when these P pluses or minuses go to zero, But this region is not special in any way. There's nothing interesting happening in the amplitude here, and so you don't get any additional enhancement. And so the fact that this region is a small slice is good enough to show that this is suppressed. Now the one technical... Now the thing we have to discuss is that for pedagogical reasons I've drawn these boundaries, but that's not at all how we do the effective theory. I mean, if you would really do these boundaries, it would maybe be fine for real emission physics, but if you do loop collections, all of this is horrible with gauge invariance. So when we do this effective theory, this soft collinear effective theory, we actually don't impose any boundaries. So for example, the soft stuff... Yes. Now let's discuss how these things are separated. So this is this part mode separation. And so there are basically three ways with which you could separate these contributions. The first way is what I just drawn here. That would be hard cutoffs. It would be a complete disaster because of gauge invariance. It would also be a disaster for your computations. Actually, cutoff is also the wrong word because it's not, I'm not really cutting anything off. It's a scale separation, and there is no dependence on this at the end of the day. I'm just slicing things up. So every single piece obviously will depend on this cutoff, which would have to be at an intermediate scale, like scaling like the square root of this lambda, for example. But then at the end, this would cancel away. Yes. Well, if I go back and add the different pieces, it would have to cancel. So it would go away, it would be fine, but it's nice for a discussion here, but in practice, you cannot really do this. Another method which you can use are subtractions, and in this skate community, these are usually called zero bin subtractions. And basically, what this means is you will not impose any hard cutoffs on these momentum regions. That would give rise to a double counting, and you avoid it by subtracting out, let's say, for example, the soft piece from this collinear contribution. So you would compute the collinear, but then subtract from the integrand its expansion around the soft limit, so that at the end there's no contribution at this power which you're considering. So this you can do, but it's tedious. Now, in practice, this is done by, so you would compute all your loop integrals, whatever appears, and then in each case, you would have to re-expand this thing around the other regions and subtract off, so that you subtract out the overlap. And I'll show you in an example in a minute. If you have many regions, this subtraction business gets very tedious if you go to higher loops too. Then there are several integrations. You have to split up everything, subtract, and et cetera. So the simplest thing is to just expand. So and I'll call this multipole expansion. But really, it's just Taylor expanding the integrands always in the small parameter. And this is something which you can only do if you have something like dimensional regularization, because if you do it, usually you end up with some additional divergences, but they're regulated. And if you expand every integral until there's only a single scale left, you know that there's no double counting. For example, if you do chiral perturbation theory, you have pion fields. You integrate the pion momenta all the way to the Planck scale. Nevertheless, since these integrals only involve a single scale, namely the pion mass, the result will be proportional to the pion mass. And so this is by far the best method. You should just expand, but consistently everywhere expand. And so I can get ahead of myself slightly. So what Tuckman et al. Didn't do is expand the jet measure. They expand the Lagrangian, but they keep the jet measure unexpanded. And then, if you do this, then you will need to perform these zero bin subtractions in order to avoid double counting. Good, so now I want to illustrate this with an example. The example is almost insulting to you because it's so trivial, but nevertheless it shows basically all the important features. So, so I'll take now an integral over rapidity. And then I want to take one particle which is collinear. So I take one particle which is in the forward region, and then the other particle can be anything it wants. So I integrate over this. Now I'll take this jet constraint. So I want to cluster things if the rapidities of the two particles are very close. As I said, there is one particle which I call y collinear, which has a large rapidity fixed, and then there's a second one which I integrate. If they're close together, they're getting clustered. I've left out here the dependence on the angle in the jet algorithm, but that's not important for the argument. Also, they would in general leave, this would be multiplied by an amplitude, but I've also set the amplitude equal to 1. I mean, also this doesn't matter, the entire features can just be understood. And this integral, this is now obviously very trivial. If I would just split my rapidity into these three different regions and put it back together, I get the original integral. So for the hard cutoffs, it's clear that they reproduce the full result. And it's also clear that if you actually compute the integral is only non-zero if this rapidity is also in this collinear region. And so you just get 2 times r of this integral. And it only has support in this narrow region around y collinear. Good. So now we do this head computation. And now things get split up. So I have that this full integral, so let's call this QCD here, where the QCD integral gets split into collinear plus anti-collinear plus soft. As I said, if you do this with a cutoff, it's trivial. You split the integral into three different regions, and then these things just give 0 because the integrand vanishes, and this gives the full contribution. If you do now this multipole expansion instead, well, so let's do it with this multipole expansion. So now I'm computing the same integral, and I will integrate in each region over the full rapidity range from minus infinity to plus infinity, but I will expand this theta function with the appropriate scaling. So for example, if I have the soft integral here, maybe I can save myself some writing. I mean, the integral is the same. So now let's compute the soft integral. I do not put any cutoff. I integrate over everything. And now I can see how these things scale. The collinear one here is a log 1 over lambda, the rapidity, so it's large. The soft one here has a rapidity of order 1. And this r squared, we're also counting as order 1. And so now we should expand. And so if you expand this theta function, then you find, well, okay, you can, the only thing you need to keep is the collinear rapidity. All the other stuff is small, so you get theta of minus y collinear squared, which is 0. Which is how it should be, since the integral only should get a contribution from this collinear region. And you can do the same exercise here. So if you do this multipole expansion, you would find that the integral becomes equal to the collinear integral, and the other two things are 0. Now let's do the final method, where I do this subtraction technique. So this is now method 2, zero bin subtraction. Now I will not expand the jet measure. Now since I've thrown out all the amplitudes and everything else, just nothing will get expanded. So what I would find is that I would get I collinear plus I soft plus I anticollinear. Let's for the moment, to make this subtraction simpler, forget about this anticollinear contribution. So then I would get a double counting, I would get twice the result which I should get. However, we now should subtract the overlap contribution where I have a scaling so that this thing is both soft and collinear. Now again, since I'm not expanding, all these integrals are exactly identical, and so the overlap would just be equal here to the soft piece, and the two cancel, and you again find that things work out. Now, if you also include this anticollinear region, then the business gets a bit more complicated. So if I do this with collinear bar, then I would have, so the integral is again collinear plus soft, and now also plus anticollinear. And now I have to subtract all the overlaps of these regions minus the overlap of collinear soft minus the overlap of anticollinear soft minus the overlap of collinear bar collinear. And now I've subtracted one region too much. So you see these overlap regions here. This is collinear soft, this is soft collinear, and then there's the collinear anticollinear. It's just one point, the overlap. But this point is the same as soft collinear and anticollinear. So these two things, well, first of all, I have to add back the thing which I subtracted twice. So I have to add back the triple overlap. But then I can use that these two things are the same, because they live both in exactly this point and have exactly the same scaling. And so what you see then is that if you use this computational scheme, you have to compute all these contributions, but then you have to do these subtractions here. Now what Tuckman et al. Did is that they computed this contribution here. Now this contribution would be the mixing term of a collinear particle and a soft particle, and they found in their computation that this part is non-zero. And then they said, well, this means that factorization breaks down. But it's clear that this is not the full computation, so if you want to compute, if you do it this way without expanding, you need to also add these things here. And in fact, this term will be exactly opposite to this one, and it will cancel it out. So the mistake here is the computation is correct, but it was an incomplete computation. They compute one term, but not the other one. Now, okay, this is in this trivial example. We did the full computation for this two-loop coefficient. For this two-loop coefficient, using this expansion technique, and we find the same result as Banvi-Salam and Sandarighi. So it's clear that indeed this expansion reproduces the QCD result. Tuckman et al. Have not yet done this computation, and you see why, because it's here, it's five different regions. This is for one emission. If you also vary this one, then it's 25 different contributions which you have to compute and add up. Once you add them up, you will end up in the same thing like the one here, and you will recover the same result. But it's much more tedious to do it this way. And there's no reason to do it. You really should just expand your integrands. And this type of subtraction technique is useful if you want to mathematically prove, for example, that these types of methods work. Because this strict expansion, this works only in dimensional regularization, but if you want to do a mathematical proof, you would like to map these Dirac integrals to standard integrals, which you can do with this type of subtraction technique. All these subtraction integrals would be scaleless integral and Dirac, but if you take them together, you find something which is again a normal integral, and then you can prove things about it. But in practice, it's you're just hurting yourself by using this type of technique. Good, so that was the main point, actually, of the discussion. I want to discuss one more technical complication, which is this collinear anomaly here. I cannot really decide which side here is for wiping and which one is for holding. The second point actually relates to this expansion here. This part is uncontroversial, so Frank and everybody else would agree that this type of effect is there and it's important and has the same structure. As I said, if you expand integrands, you will end up with divergences usually, and you have to regularize them. Often Dirac is good enough, but not always. And for these type of transverse momentum-dependent observables, you find that there are additional divergences which are not regularized dimensionally. So if you do this expansion, even just on the Lagrangian level, you end up with light cone singularities in these integrals, which is a problem, so you need to regularize them. And it's a non-trivial problem because you would like to regularize them in such a way that you don't destroy gauge invariance, that the effective theory has the same structure as it has before. Fortunately, these divergences only affect real emission diagrams, which makes it much easier. So since the additional divergences only affect real emissions, all you have to do is you have to regularize your phase space integrals. And the way you can do this is that you take your usual phase space measure and then you replace it by a regularized version, which looks like this. You take one of these Lycon components, which is positive, and you raise it to power alpha. Now what this does, it softens these Lycon divergences. It's very similar to dimensional regularization, except that instead of epsilon, you now have this alpha, and instead of this scale mu that you have in Dirac, you have this scale nu. It also turns out that one component is good enough. So since there's a delta function here, you can integrate, for example, over this k plus component, and then you find that the same thing also regularizes the k minus component. So with this regulator, you regularize these additional singularities, which appear.
In the end, you take alpha to zero.
Sorry?
In the end, you take alpha to zero.
Exactly, and then you will add the collinear soft and anticollinear back together, and you take alpha to zero, and the divergences have to go away in very much the same way that the in-between scale separation would have to be in a way, would go away. So
why the in-dimensionalization is not enough?
The problem is that Dirac basically regularizes the transverse directions. I mean, if you rewrite it in Lycon coordinates, you have integral k plus, k minus, and the transverse. And the transverse is in d minus 2 dimensions. So the transverse is always regularized. And often this regularization, then after you integrate over it, propagates onto the other components. But if you have observables where you restrict the transverse momentum, for example, if you put here a delta function of the transverse momentum, a d-dimensional one, then it will kill the transverse momentum integration, and what you're left with is then these Lycon integrations. And if you have Lycon propagators, then you can end up with these divergences. These are not there in QCD. They only arise after you do this expansion. And these things will cancel out once you add them back together. But in order to make sense of the individual soft and collinear contributions, you have to introduce this. By the way, this was work done with Guido Bell. And I should mention that there's an alternative framework, so C also or something, by Pittsburgh, by the Pittsburgh group or former Pittsburgh group, who have an alternative regularization scheme which does the same thing. Good, so you'll get these divergences until cancel. Let me show this schematically. For example, if you compute now an integral from this collinear region here, you'll see that the integral now has a factor nu over k plus to the alpha. And k plus scales like m Higgs, it's large. And so what you'll get is a factor nu over m Higgs to the power alpha, just by scaling from the integral here. If you compute the opposite direction here, the anticollinear one, you'll also find a divergence. However, now this k plus is the small component in the opposite side. So small means that it scales like pt vito squared over m Higgs, again to the power alpha. And you see now what happens is the divergence here, once you expand in alpha, will cancel. But something remains because these two things scale differently in the different regions. You now get a log. And so what you'll find is that you get a log pt vito squared over m Higgs squared plus terms which vanish after you send alpha to zero. This is an interesting effect because it means that even in your low energy theory, you generate a large log of pt over m Higgs. So that's surprising. We call this effect the collinear anomaly. If this alpha regularization wouldn't be there, then you could actually show that these collinear and soft things would be independent of m Higgs. So there would be a symmetry which would tell you it cannot depend on m Higgs. The high end, the low energy theory is independent. But this breaks the symmetry, and if you take alpha to zero at the end, you're not recovering the symmetry. So this symmetry is anomalous, and you get this log. This is potentially dangerous because you need to resum these logs. So you need to know what the structure of these logs is to all orders. But you can do this because you know that they have to cancel among the different sectors and because you know how the different pieces must scale. Oops. So you can write down a set of sort of consistency equations. Doesn't like me. Set of consistency equations for this cancellation.
That log in QCD.
Sorry?
Is a British log in
QCD? Yeah, you can. In some sense, you can view it as a log from the integration over this rapidity here. And so that's, for example, why Chu et al. Call this the rapidity. They call it the rapidity renormalization group. What they do is that they take these pieces and then they do kind of a renormalization. So they subtract this 1 over alpha divergence and keep the rest. The rest will then depend on nu. And then you can do a dd log nu, and it gives you an equation. And you can solve this equation to exponentiate these logs. And so this they call the rapidity renormalization group because it works on the rapidities, not on the virtuality. But I mean, this is perfectly fine. On the other hand, this type of scale nu doesn't enter any coupling, so it's not the same. It's much simpler, this type of RG equation, and you can just solve it by writing down these consistency equations, and what you find then is that the cross-section looks like this. So we have the hard function as before, but then you get an additional factor which arises from these anomalous logs. And it has this form m Higgs squared over pt vito squared, not square, minus 2 times some exponent, and this exponent only depends on pt. So you can show that this additional dependence has the form of a pure power. So it's very special, very constrained, similar to regular anomalies who also have a constrained form. So it just exponentiates. And then what remains is, again, these collinear functions, psi 1, pt beta, and then you will integrate this over the rapidity. So it's the same formula as before, but you've now extracted this hidden dependence on the Higgs mass, and then the remaining elements here are no longer dependent on anything, or at least not on M Higgs. And you have also, what you can also do is, you can take the square root of the soft function and absorb it into the collinear ones. I mean, the soft function is a function of PT, so you can easily absorb the square root into this function. And in fact, if you use this type of regulator, the entire soft contribution is just scaleless integral. So you find that the soft function is just one. No, you don't need to write it explicitly. With this Chu et al. Regulator, it's non-zero, but you can do the same step and absorb it.
So what is the mu?
So I should just put a... I don't know, there's some confusion here with Higgs and mu's. All these functions depend on mu, which is the usual Dirac RG scale. And in fact, you can then use the renormalization group evolution to evolve this from a high scale to a low scale, which resums the logs. Here you will just say mu of order pt, so there are no large logs here, and there are no large logs here. And so you have resummed all your logs. Good. So if you want, you can add here a soft function of PT, as I had in my original formula. But if you actually compute it with this regulator, you find that you always get an integral over the total rapidity from minus infinity to plus infinity with a power of rapidity to the alpha. So it's a scaleless integral, and it's just zero. So this is, in our regularization scheme, this is just one to all orders in perturbation theory.
But in IRAS prescription,
it's non-zero, because instead of k plus here, they put the energy k zero, that is their scheme. Then it's non-zero. I mean, again, this alpha dependence will completely vanish at the end, so the product of the three functions is exactly the same. But the splitting is a bit different. It's like if you choose a slightly different boundary here between soft and collinear. It's like, in our case, we basically move this in so that at the end we really only have one collinear and then one anticollinear, while they still have these three contributions. But it gives the same result at the end. Putting a k0 here makes the integrals more difficult, because you already have light cone denominators in this scale diagram. So putting a k plus here is not an essential complication. Putting a k0, will need more work. And so with this regulator, there are now three different two-loop computations which have been performed. So this framework has been checked, and it works at the two-loop order in explicit computations. They haven't yet done a two-loop computation, partly because they're American, so they're less driven towards doing seven-loop computations, but partly also because it's more work for them, because the regulator complicates the integrals. Good. So this is the final form of this factorization theorem. What we have done is we have computed this exponent here to two-loop accuracy analytically. And then we have extracted these functions here numerically. So if we divide by this prefactor here, then there's no M Higgs dependence. So we take a fixed order code called HNNLO from Grazzini. We run it for very high Higgs masses, and then we divide out this prefactor. And then what remains are these beam functions, and the power corrections go away. And so in this way, we can get numerically also these functions. And this function h here is known extremely precisely. So this is known at the three-loop level. So we have this at three-loop, we have these at two-loop, this also at two-loop. Now, if you want to resum the first three towers of logs, you actually would also need this function here at three-loops. And the reason is that this here is an exponential of a log m Higgs over pt, but the log counts like 1 over alpha, so you need to go one order higher in the exponent than in the functions here. And so this three-loop function we don't have. We have all the mu-dependent pieces here from solving the RG equation, but we don't have the three-loop constant. And so this we estimate, it's a small effect, but still it would be interesting to also get this three loop constant. So the end result, which we'll publish soon, will be this N3 leading log with a little p, and the little p means there's a three loop constant which is still missing. Partial. Yeah, there's a lot of different, there's people putting primes, p's and whatnot, so. So let me show you some numerical results now. Well, what happens is these power collections, PT or M Higgs?
PT.
Well, if PT becomes large, then we're sort of going away from this effective theory picture, and then the power corrections become large, and you just recover the full rate. And so this is a smooth limit, you can do it, but in this limit, this computation is no longer really useful. Now, what you see here is the full result for the cross-section with the Vita, which we get, and below here are these power corrections, so these power suppressed terms. Now there's a statement which I said, the power corrections are fairly small. I mean, even if you have PT equal to 30, most of this is leading power in the expansion, just a small fraction of it is power suppressed terms. So this effective theory limit that we treat PT as small is a good approximation for the PT values which are actually used. The other thing which you notice is that things depend on this jet radius. So, as we said in the beginning, if you make the jet radius small, you get logs of the jet radius, which are not resummed. And these logs can spoil the perturbative series, and you kind of see it. So, what is used experimentally is 0.4 and 0.5. If you would use 0.8, everything would look pretty nicely beautiful. So this is what you have. Then you go one order higher, both in the matching and in the resummation. Things overlap and look nice. If you lower it, these jumps are getting larger. And at 0.2, you're in a situation where you're no longer sure whether what you do is really applicable or not. The corrections are kind of large. So you also see that our uncertainties then start to blow up. So if you want to get a more precise result, one thing you could do is increase the jet radius, and you could actually do this experimentally. It's not trivial because you start sucking up more things, but then you could try to filter this out. So I think they're contemplating actually going to a larger jet radius in order to. Yes. I mean, even better would be if one of you figures out how to resum these logs so far. This we've discussed. So there are these power collections. I've said they're not very large. Here is just the percentage of the power collections. So clearly depends on the PT. If you go to higher PT, they become larger. Interestingly, they're not very strongly dependent on R. So increasing or decreasing R, not much happens. While the picture that it would only work at very low R, what should then happen is that the formula breaks down, so you would see that these things somehow explode. Now, one reason why we went one order higher in this paper was exactly this anomaly coefficient. So this D2 is the two-loop constant in this F function, which we have analytically. But the thing to notice is that it's very large. If you take R small, I mean, it has this log R enhancement. If you take R of order 1, which is how this jet algorithm originally was intended, then the correction, this two-loop coefficient is roughly the same size as the two-loop coefficient that is relevant for the Higgs PT spectrum. So you get a fairly well-behaved series. If you go to 0.4, you've already almost six times as large a perturbative correction. So some of these coefficients become large. If you go to 0.2, basically eight times the correction. So these things become large, which prompted us to go one order higher. However, at one order higher, we do not know this coefficient. What we do know is that it will scale like log squared. and we can see how the lower one goes. If you assume, well, we know it's one power of the law more. If you assume that sort of the scaling of the prefactor continues like this, that it has the same large 4 times CA coefficient coming in with roughly the same prefactor, then this is the effect. It's a very small effect if the jet radius is large, but it becomes no longer completely negligible at 0.2, and then it increases even further if you go below this. But still, this is, I think the estimate is conservative. This is a fairly large alpha cubed coefficient. So we're putting 4 times CA, and we have these extra logs. Even with this large coefficient, the corrections are not huge. So we think that, well, we hope that this will not affect the result too much. It should be possible to compute this log, this double log, because the double log comes from diagrams with 2 emissions. So I would have to look at these type of diagrams in the limit where these jets are narrowly clustered, and then you can try to extract this. And it should be possible to do it, but we haven't done it. But I'm sure sooner or later this will be done. Let me compare to the results of Banfield to finish off. They do not compute the cross-section. Instead, they work with the efficiency. And the reason they prefer the efficiency is that they want to divide out the large corrections to the total rate. However, because these are large, it depends what definition of the efficiency you give. You can define the efficiency as the ratio of the Vito cross-section to the total cross-section. Expand the numerator and the denominator separately and take the ratio. That's this scheme A, and this is their default. Or you can just take the efficiency itself and expand the efficiency, which gives this other band here. Or you can define it in a third way as 1 minus the cross-section for more than one jet divided by the total cross-section. So these are the 3 schemes. Our results are in agreement with their results. They agree perfectly with scheme B, but I think there's absolutely no reason why they should, or I don't see any reason why the scheme B should be the one which is closest. None of these are exactly what we do.
So the results for them, are actually their numbers, or do you calculate using their scheme?
Now, these are their numbers. They actually released a public code.
Yeah.
Where they have these things. The way they generate their final number is that they consider these 3 schemes, but they say, well, scheme A is our default, and scale variation we're only doing scheme A. And then they look at the differences between the default predictions to the other schemes and add this as an error. So if you look at their paper, at the end of the day, you will find the upper line is the upper line here. The lower line of the band is the lower line here, which is sort of the difference to the scheme B.
Yeah, no, I guess I'm asking because they shift things around compared to how you guys do it. And you never quote results with your methods for NNLO plus NNLO.
We never.
And so if you calculated with a similar scheme, how closely would you agree?
I mean,
because you showed NLO plus NNLO.
Well, we have the same, okay, we have 1 log or half a log more, but it's the same type of matching. So both match to fixed order. We also have this part of this 3 loop term in the exponent. We don't believe that it's a good idea to do this division for the efficiency, because the only thing that cancels out in this ratio are the virtual corrections. It's in this hard function cancels out. But this hard function is known to 3 loop accuracy. So we know this part of the total cross section, we know at the level of 1%. Now dividing by it, you also put the real emission corrections in there, and those are only known at the 10% level. So you pick up a 10% additional uncertainty by doing this division. So we're not really dividing. So our thing here is we take our value and divide by our default Higgs cross-section, but we're not expanding.
Yeah, I agree. You said I'm just wondering, what is the effect of doing the resummation a slightly different way, but to the same perturbative accuracy?
The technical, well, we could do this. We could leave off the 3 loop parts in the exponent and then compare. And maybe it would be a good idea to do this. I mean, it's, yeah. it's again the two things agree reasonably well, but it would be interesting maybe to understand a bit better why they agree with scheme two. Naively, actually, I would have more expected that it agrees with scheme one, or it should agree with scheme one. This, yeah. Okay. Good, so that's it. Sorry for going over time.